Good afternoon, everyone. Here's another in the transcribed series that we call Information Desk, a series devoted to answering some of the many questions that you and your neighbors ask every day about your town, your government, your surroundings, the day's news. If there's some question that you have in mind that has yet to be answered, send it to us here at Information Desk, WCOP in Boston, and we'll do our level best to find an answer for you. Today's program was to be devoted to a discussion of the ills and cures of Boston's traffic and parking problems, which affect us all. However, that particular program will be heard next week at 2:30. The change was made because of Operation White Tower. Well, what about Operation White Tower? If you'll drag a convenient divan a little closer to our information desk here at 1150 on your dial, we'll explain what Operation White Tower is. If I asked you what you might find at 20,300 feet altitude, what would be your answer? Well, you might say that an Army B-29 bomber on a high-altitude mission could be found there. Or you might hazard that a cloud formation could be found at that height. Or maybe, under unusual circumstances, a bird may be lifted that high by thermal drafts in the higher sky. But chances are, you'd never say that you'd find a man walking about at 20,300 feet above sea level. Well, you'd be wrong, for in a comparatively short time, there will be a man walking about 20,300 feet up, and that's way up. He may not be promenading or strolling leisurely, but he'll be up there, walking at over 20,000 feet with his feet on the ground and his head at 20,306 feet up in the sky. His name? Bradford Washburn, director of the New England Museum of Natural History and director of Operation White Tower, this year's expedition to the top of Mount McKinley in Alaska, North America's highest peak. Mr. Washburn and his party are leaving this evening to begin their trip to Alaska, where already supplies are waiting at 6,000 feet for the party as they begin their climb of this amazing mass of snow, ice, and rock that makes Mount McKinley. Well, to find out more about Operation White Tower and what the ascent will mean, we have sitting across our information desk from us today, Bradford Washburn. Mr. Washburn, my claim to mountain climbing fame goes no further than puffing up Beacon Hill in a January snowstorm. So I'll ask a question or two, and you can tell all of us about Operation White Tower. As a matter of fact, that name bears a marked resemblance to James Ramsey Ullman's novel White Tower, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
Was there any particular reason for choosing this particular name?
Well, yes, in truth there is, because we felt that McKinley is a great white tower, and because also we have a couple of cameramen who are going with us, and on this trip they are going to learn how to take photographs under the most extremely difficult high altitude and cold conditions, mm-hmm. so that they can go to Europe later on to take the film of the White Tower over there.
Oh, I see. Well, from your experience, you'd say that Mount McKinley is the best training ground you know of for operations in cold, wouldn't you?
I can't think of a better place in the world where you could get some training in professional freezing.
That sounds very unlikely that I'd be highly enthused about something like that. Well, since we didn't really begin at the beginning, let's go back to the beginning. Let's go back to the day when Mount McKinley was climbed for the first time. Do you know anything about that at all?
Yes, McKinley's been climbed three times in all.
Mm-hmm.
The first time was back in 1913 by Archdeacon Hudson Stuck, the Archdeacon of the Yukon, who'd mm-hmm. spent most of his life up there. And he'd been in the lowlands, dog-teaming back and forth between his missions, and he'd seen McKinley towering off towards the south, and he'd just got a yen to get to the top. And he and three companions, two of them local sourdoughs, made the ascent in June 1913. Then 19 years elapsed, and it was climbed again by Al Lindley of Minneapolis and Erling Strom, incidentally, who now is a ski instructor up in Stowe, Vermont,
mm-hmm.
and two companions, and that added eight people in all to the number who've been to the summit. And then in 1942, 10 years later, an Army party sent seven men to the summit, doing cold weather testing of Army equipment in midsummer, and I was in that party.
Now, you actually have made the ascent previous to this particular expedition, haven't you?
Yes, I've done it once,
mm-hmm.
In July 1942. You'll be amused to Here, too, the warmest night we had up there in July, to be exact, the 23rd of July, was 17 below zero.
Citizens of Boston, please take note. Our winters aren't so tough after all. Well, now that we've established a partial history of man against mountain, let's go on to the purposes, or purpose, I understand they're fivefold, concerning your trip this time.
Well, we have, as you said, several purposes. I think the most important one is our cosmic ray research that we're doing for Dr. Marcel Shine, the famous research physicist of the University of Chicago.
Well, let's run over that briefly in lay language then, so that both
well,
myself...
Well, frankly, I am not a research physicist myself, but the work that we're going to do is to set up a station which will be operated by a physicist who's being sent by Dr. Shine. A fellow called Hugo Victorine of Chicago, erstwhile of Pittsfield, Massachusetts.
Oh, really?
So we have several New Englanders in the party. And it is our job to get Victorine set up somewhere between 15,000 and 18,000 feet on the mountain.
Well, that's close to the summit then, actually, isn't it?
It's pretty high up, yes. With all his equipment, we've got about roughly a ton and a half of equipment that has to be mainly parachuted to him up there by the Army Air Forces. Then when we've got him there... from there on in, he has got to carry out these observations. Now, I think one of the things you first say was you've seen in the papers every day that B-29s are studying cosmic rays at altitudes of 35 and 40,000 feet, so why study them at 18? B-29s can't stay up that high very long. And what Chicago wants to find out is what the diurnal variations of cosmic rays are. Are there more of them at night than in the daytime? Is the incidence of them greater in the Arctic at that altitude over a steady period of a day or 2 days, or maybe, if we're lucky, as much as 10 days?
Well, that'll also help your Air Corps work, because if there are no, or there aren't many of these diurnal variations, then that means that your B-29 readings are fairly accurate then, doesn't it?
Yes, I think it will be very important, whatever we find out. If we find out that there are variations, that will be very significant. If we find out that there will be there are none at all, that will be equally significant.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, after you and your party set up Mr. What was his name? I forgot.
Victorine?
Mr. Victorine on his 18,000-foot perch up there with all his equipment, then you will continue with your other purposes of the trip, won't you?
Yes, but most of our work, aside from the weather work, which we will be doing at the same point as Victorine's cosmic ray research, most of our work will be done below that altitude.
Oh, it will.
It happens that this pass, where we're our 18,000-foot camp we hope we'll establish, is a place from which you can see very little of the surrounding country, because you have the big summit of the South Peak of McKinley on one side of you, and the great summit and cliffs of the North Peak, which is 500 or 600 feet lower than the actual top, on the other side. And they block the view, so that we can't do survey work. But we will carry out a certain amount of geologic work up there. We want to get a series of specimens of the rocks from both of the summits for the geological survey. And we're carrying out some rather interesting weather observations for the Weather Bureau in connection with determining how cold the mountain is and what effect it has on the surrounding air.
Well, it sounds like you're talking about a new refrigerator instead of a mountain.
Well, what we plan to do is really very simple, is to have our thermometers set up at this camp, and at the same time have aircraft approaching the mountain from a distance of 15 or 20 miles at exactly the same altitude at which we're camped. And they can tell, as they approach the mountain, from the variations of their thermometer to ours, the effect, the chilling effect that McKinley has on the air around it. And I can assure you it's plenty.
Well, in other words, this tremendous mass of ice and snow and rock sounds like a tremendous ice cube that's being stuck up there that actually affects the weather in that immediate vicinity, doesn't it?
Oh, it does. I've seen terrific snowstorms and all sorts of bad weather right around McKinley, where it's absolutely clear within 20 miles of it.
And that's what you're out there to determine, is by temperature and other studies, how this mountain does affect the weather.
Yes.
With the assistance of the Army Air Forces, of course. You mentioned something about geology. Will you have a geologist with you on the party?
No, Bob Lang of the University of New Hampshire is studying geology, but he is not a geologist, and the work we've got to do in geology is very, very simple. We simply have to collect geologic specimens, just rocks about as big as your fist, from a number of different outcrops that the Geological Survey in Washington have asked us to bring samples back from, so that they can then study later on the exact makeup of the peak.
Well, the mountain itself, of course, has never been surveyed, and that's going to be one of your purposes on the trip this time, isn't it, to locate definitely certain peaks and certain ravines and outcroppings, or...
Yes, we planned in connection with the Army Air Forces who are doing a thorough photographic mapping job on the peak from 35,000 feet, vertical picture looking straight down on it. We're planning to do the ground control work that will make it possible to tie these pictures in and make an accurate map out of them.
In other words, the old aerial maps that we used during the war, somewhat along the same line, and you're there to make sure that these photographs of the mountain are accurate.
Yes, and our job, really, if you compare it to putting up a big building, is that it's our job to build the steel framework to which the details which you get from the aerial photographs are attached.
So when you get through, future generations will have an accurate picture of the mountain. Does the mountain itself, that is, your glaciers and outcroppings and everything, does that vary from year to year because of snow or icing conditions or other weather?
Well, it varies a certain amount,
but
very, very little. The summit of McKinley, when we climbed it, looked just exactly in our pictures as it looked to Hudson Stuck when he climbed it in 1913.
Those many, many years ago.
Yes, there were two big snow drifts, perhaps 50 feet apart, packed as hard as a rock. Even with ice creepers, you could walk along them, and it was as hard as walking on concrete. And the winds seemed to keep gouging the peak in pretty much the same way. And then the rock outcrops govern where the wind flows, and between the outcrops, the snow is gouged out by the wind, and it drifts behind them in the shelter.
Well, now, just there, you mentioned something that brought to mind something that you had mentioned previous to our broadcast, and that was that when you drop equipment such as oil drums or other heavy equipment down upon the mountain, many people think it'll immediately be covered in case of a snowstorm. However, you advise me that because of the winds that it won't be.
Well, that depends on where you drop it.
I see.
You've got to know pretty much the kind of a mountain you're dealing with before you drop the stuff, and you've got to know where to drop it. Because when you drop equipment with people on the ground, obviously the best place to drop it is to have them in a place where they're sheltered and where the wind won't blow your equipment around at all. If you drop it when they're not on the ground, you want to choose a place where it's very windy, so that the wind will keep blowing the equipment away. You've seen trees out in the meadows here after a big blow, and the wind will always gouge a hole on the windward side of the tree and all around it and put a drift up about a foot or so high on the lee side. And actually, I've found parcels that we've dropped a month before and then come in on the ground and picked them up, and we've found them not because of the parcel itself, but because of the drift behind. And then we've dug to the windward of the drift and found the buried parcel.
And there's your equipment. Well, now our time's running out on us, Mr. Washburn. Just two questions briefly. First, when do you plan to make your attempt on McKinley?
We plan to actually get up onto the upper part of the mountain toward the middle of May.
Toward
and
the middle
be there
of May.
Until early June.
And about what time do you figure your work will be over and you can come down to come back?
We'll be out, we hope, around June 15th.
I see. And, of course, your job when you get back here will be to supervise the moving and beginning of construction, won't it, for the new New England Museum of Natural History?
Well, we hope it won't be long before we can go to work, but it's going to be a little while. We can't start building with things the way they are now.
Well, before we close, we wish to wish you success on your Mount McKinley trip and also hope that we can be striding into your new museum before too very long.
Well, we surely hope you'll be coming in soon.
Well, thank you, Bradford Washburn, director of the New England Museum of Natural History, and also Chief in Command of Operation White Tower. So there's your information desk program for today. We'll see you again next Sunday at 2:30.